Hey, just a heads up that the following content may be disturbing or triggering for some listeners and is not appropriate for children. Please take care of yourself and others who may be listening with you. Welcome to the Bonus Babies Podcast, a show that has no easy answers, only hard questions.
And so I'm sitting across from this attorney that's 80 plus years old, and he had a lot to say. And one of the things was, and you know, we ended up on good terms. You know, I don't say this to be malicious, but he was just like, state of Kentucky. Like, you could already see like the judgment. And then I became proud. So when he questioned me, I said, yes, I am a product of, you know, foster care. I aged out at 18, and they were considered my parents until 21. Furthermore, I was on their insurance until 26 because they are my legal guardian. I'm proud of the fact that I'm sitting in this chair across from you about ready to become an attorney, because as you know, with that, just that right there, that it's very unlikely that I would end up here. So I wear that as a badge of honor. I don't deflect from my history because I think it says more about me and what I'm capable of than any of the stereotypes that people want to throw out there, because I don't match a stereotype, which causes people to think and to question their beliefs and to be like, well, maybe all foster youth are actually capable of more, but X, Y, and Z.
Can you tell me what you call the kids who you've cared for over the years?
We feel that the children that we receive coming into our home are bonuses. So we call them bonus babies.
I love that.
This is your host, Jane Amelia Larson, and I'm Akasa, a court-appointed special advocate volunteer for youth in foster care. Yeah, I know, it's a mouthful. In the same way Akasa works, I explore all things in the foster care maze by talking to kids, parents, caregivers, attorneys, social workers, therapists, really anybody and everybody who will speak to me to keep the conversation open and the information flowing about all things CASA.
Hi, this is Jake Eberle, the producer of the Bonus Babies podcast. And today, Jane Amelia speaks with Glenda Wright. Glenda is an attorney and former foster youth from Kentucky who for the past 10 years has dedicated herself to improving the child welfare system so that other youth and families like hers don't have to experience what she and so many others had to. Here's her story.
Hey, I'm here with Glenda Wright. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good, and thanks for working that out. We had some tech issues. So can you tell me a little bit about who you are, where you're from, family of origin, anything you want to share?
Yes. As you kindly gave me a nice introduction, I am Glenda Wright. I am from Owensboro, Kentucky. Big shout out to my Kentuckians out there.
Okay, watch out, because my boyfriend is from UGA, so he has a problem with Kentucky, just so you know. Okay, I'm just saying.
Dang. You hate to see it. You hate to see it. You know, we're all biased, right? To some extent.
Somewhere or other. It just creeps up.
It does. So I wear those kind of biases proudly. But so if you don't know much about Kentucky, I grew up in a pretty smallish town there in Owensboro. And then I moved to a much smaller town for college. So that was a fun adventure. My family dynamic and makeup is as complicated as my history. So I like to say I have my bio family who I am extremely close with. Those bonds are as strong as, you know, anything. And then I have my adopted family where I did an adoption through Christ. So I am one of 11 and I am the only adopted child. So mom is a trooper of 10. Plus me.
I'm from a family of 10. I'm number 9. So you're number 11.
Dang.
Out of 11. Oh my gosh, you lucky girl.
Yes, but I'm technically the middle child. So I have Sophia. So I have 3 under me. Maybe 4. Yeah, I think 4. As you know, it all gets a little complicated because all the babies, they come so quick. And then I have my last foster mom who I consider to be one of my 2 mothers. A really unique setup. And in that family, I am one of a bunch because she has been fostering for many, many, many years.
Right. So she's your foster mom. So you have two bonus moms, right? And one bio mom. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That's great. So you got three moms. That's excellent.
I have two. I do not actually have a relationship with my bio mother.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. So how did you end up in care? What happened?
Well, that's a fun little story. So I would say my original placement with foster care, I believe I'd have to go back and look at the records, but I believe I was 2 years old. So in my bio family, I'm one of three, and I am also a middle child. So my mother, you know, really struggled with mental health issues and drug misuse. And so through those kind of struggles, we all actually ended up in my grandmother's care. So we did a couple of in and outs whenever I was really adolescent. But for the most part, my grandmother was the primary caregiver for me and my siblings. And so at the age of newly turned 14 in 2009, my grandmother unfortunately passed away. And so with that passing, there really wasn't, to the state standards, someone that could come in and take all of us. And so they made the unilateral decision to place all four of us back into foster care. And so from that initial placement at 14, I was in foster care with no pop-ins and pops-out, fully in care from 14 until 21. And then at some point before the age of 18, both of my parents actually went through the TPR process, so termination of parental rights. And so I'm actually just submitted my bar application. And one of the questions is, who are your parents? And so I have to put, and I do put, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, because as you know, TPR means there, I do not have parents of record. And so the Commonwealth of Kentucky is my parents, both mother and father. And so I put that in my application. And I remember the first lawyer that interviewed me, he was like really confused. He was just like, what do you mean Commonwealth of Kentucky? What are your mom and dad's names? And then I had to, of course, unfortunately disclose the history and just say, you know, I have to put everything as accurate according to the law for the bar application. And so on record, I don't technically have a mother or a father. That would be the state of Kentucky.
Well, what an interesting challenge for you, because of course, yeah, if you're on your way to becoming an attorney, and if I recall correctly, you started and then you said, no, I'm not doing that. But now you're doing it again.
So long story short, I've been in paid child welfare field for actually 10 plus years. So, you know, labor of love, I did some volunteer work, but a lot of portions of it were paid. So that's very fortunate for me. And then through that, I actually ended up in my commissioner's office. So the top of the top for child welfare in Kentucky, did that for almost 2 years. And then whenever I felt called to kind of leave, that's when I actually moved into law school. A year and a half into law school, I thought I would go the traditional route. I never wanted to go to law school to be a lawyer. I actually just wanted the educational acuity to understand the system I was in at some points and the systems that other people were in so that I could better help people. But you know how you get in there and, you know, stars and dazzles. And so I was like, okay, you know, had a hard time in the work because it's so closely aligned to my story. I'm going to go ahead and take a little break and move to be a lawyer. Well, a year and a half in, I like to say I had a calling from Jesus, what have you, whatever people believe in. And I actually somehow got a bug and I was just like, I felt called to open up my own child welfare consulting firm. So in law school, I was that person that participated. I was vice president of this. I was president of that. I opened up this firm a year and a half in. I was clerking for a big firm. I was doing all this stuff. And I was like, Glenda, you already got an offer for, you know, something. And so, you know, you thought that's what you wanted. And then to like change it up and go back into something where you kind of struggled a little bit because it was so closely tied to you. But I felt called to do that. So from that moment on, did a Washington, D.C. internship for foster care type stuff right after law school. I was going to do the bar and some life things happened. And it was just another kind of, oh, okay, this is more proof. And so after that, I just really decided I didn't want to utilize my law degree in a very typical way. But after D.C. and seeing kind of what is needed for policy changes at the federal level, I kind of was recommended to go ahead and get that bar. That way I could do some of the legal aspects. So yes, I have decided now that it's going to work with everything I kind of envision my life about to be, I'm going to go ahead and sit for that bar, but only in the caveat, and I have to let all my family know this because they get so excited, not to be a traditional practitioner, but to further my goal of really cementing my work in the foster care arena. I want to dig even deeper and go even wider and bigger. And to do that, I'm going to probably need that law degree at some point. So let's just do it, right?
Okay. Wow. Wow. All right. You're wowing me. So do you know that you're really ambitious? Has anybody told you that? is this a thing for you?
Oh man. Honestly, I will not share my resume, but it is a thing. I literally ran my first campaign successfully at 21. I passed my first law at 21. So some might say I started pretty young and I hit the ground running. But when you're passionate and you see such a need for me, it's not a choice. Like some people are like, oh, Glenda, you know, don't work six jobs or don't do X, Y, and Z. You need to calm down and you need to relax. Right. But there's a need out there. So if not me, then who? And that's another part of my story. I've been fortunate and unfortunate to work with a lot of different organizations in this work. And I won't give names, but I would say more than I'm comfortable with, we're not living their values. So I personally don't think it has to be Glenda Wright, but it has to be someone. You know, I gave it 10 years. If I'm not finding that someone or that something, then like, I'm called to stand on the front lines and do what needs to be done. And so that's honestly what motivates me, is just knowing that there's such a need and there's such a knowledge gap, right? And so I've been given that knowledge. So it's time to pass it on.
Yeah, that's of course, because of your background, you bring a lot to the table, and because you've educated yourself and sounds like overworked yourself too, you've learned a heck of a lot. Right. But I just want to go back to, so what happened to your siblings? Were you placed together? Were you separated after your grandmom died? How did that play out?
So it played out pretty typical as far as if you look at other stories, right? So it was my understanding that the state, there are people that were open to kin placements, but it seems as though now that I'm able to read my records, that the kin placements wanted two and two, and they didn't want all four. Now, these are people that obviously were already in our lives, and even if they took two of us, they were still going to keep the connections and all that. But for that reasoning, it's my understanding that the state thought it would be better to just remove all four of us together in the hopes of doing a sibling placement, which sounds great on paper. For me, I was in that sibling placement in no time, and it felt as though my siblings actually got sent to different homes. And so we were not placed together for most of my time in care. Just that first initial placement was together, but again, initial. And then each of us kind of got sent, shipped off, however you want to say it, to different foster homes, to where by the end of it, all four of us were in completely different homes, not able to appropriately visit each other and all that stuff. So one of us stayed in the same home. So they only went through two placements, with the last placement, in my opinion, being a very healthy placement, very nice, great family. My oldest brother went to residential, as you could probably imagine. That was really hard. It was residential for someone that didn't need residential, just an older person that couldn't get placed. And so through that kind of restricted access, I did not have the right, being under 18, to visit my own brother, even though his residential facility was across the street from our high school. But I didn't have the right to walk over there and see my brother unless I had someone 18 and older that could attend the visit with me. So even though we were always that close, I hardly ever got to see my brother, even living in the same city. Now, the other brother, with only the two placements, he lived about 2.5 hours away. So I think I didn't see him most of my time in care. But once I turned 18, I got a vehicle and I made sure to start visiting him and making that trip and picking him up and doing all that stuff. And then my brother that's 1 year above me, I don't even know how many placements he had. He probably had about as many as me. And I think if I go back and look at the records, I had 7 placements in 3 or 4 years.
Could you tell by the records? And by the way, I acknowledge the fact that the records almost never include the child's words or thoughts or feelings or our desires, right? It's just other people talking about you or writing about you, and who knows what's true. But did you get a sense of why you were placed so many times in different homes?
Yes. So this is just my own thoughts and assumptions based off of what I personally know to be true and what I was able to garner through the records. So I think some of it's typical. So I was older, you know, I'm 14 plus. So that's one thing. I'm an older youth. Initially, probably because of the sibling group, honestly, because a sibling group of 4 is very, 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 very difficult to place. And I don't want to downplay that. So there's probably some of that age. I do think if you look at the statistics, I do unfortunately think race had a part to play. I live in a predominantly Caucasian area. And based off of the data, we typically have a really hard time placing older youth plus older youth with a different race. It's very hard to place. So I think it was some of that. And then again, I had just lost my grandmother, who was my mother for all intents and purposes. And I have experienced a lot of trauma and grief in my life, but I had never experienced basically a parental death. So with that, of course, comes issues. And I'm sure that played a part in it. And then, of course, you have one episode or one issue. Maybe you don't listen immediately. And then all of a sudden you have issues with authority and all this jazz. I know one interesting thing, which was with my last placement. So this probably didn't go into play, but just to kind of show you what they kind of documented as an issue. I remember I had gotten my very first job at Little Caesars, and my mom loves to tell this story. My foster mom, who I consider to be one of my mothers. But I had always worked maybe underneath, or I didn't know it was illegal at the time, but you know how someone will send you off to go work, earn $5. So I had worked most of my childhood, honestly, in different ways. But I had finally gotten an official job at Little Caesars, and I was making my own money. Now, I grew up in poverty. So if you know anything about poverty, it's almost like a hoard thing. So now I'm able to realize what it was now, but I didn't then. So I had bought a pizza, right, from my pizza job. And that was the very first thing I had ever been able to buy with my money. So I ate the pizza and I was going to keep the box. Now, obviously, I know that wasn't rational, but at a 15, 16-year-old mindset with a trauma background, it made a lot of sense to me. I had spent my hard-earned money. No one could technically take this pizza box, but this away from me because I had bought it. And so they had no rights, pretty legal even back then. And so I was going to keep the pizza box. Well, my mom tried to throw it away and tried to force me to get rid of it. And I kind of did not react very well to that. Nothing crazy, but we just got into a bickering, you know, disagreement, argument, but nothing physical or anything like that. That's not my type. I'll argue with words all day. And so she wanted me to get rid of the box. And I told her plainly, well, Mom, I did my legal research and you can't actually force me to get rid of the pizza box because I spent my own money. And so we ended up having to call in the social worker. And, you know, we have a really close relationship. And, you know, he was able to, quote unquote, convince me to throw the pizza box away. But I expressed to him and I tried to express to her the reason I didn't want to give up the pizza box. So it felt very much like someone was taking something again from me. And so that's really what triggered me. But if you read that and you were maybe a foster parent, you would maybe not think of it from the lens of trauma, even though all foster parents should be appropriately trained, but we know they're not.
They're not. Sometimes,
some places. Mm-hmm. And so she did not have the lens of trauma to be able to step down to my level to communicate to me. So I really don't consider it her failure. We would love to think that people in their busy lives should go do the research and all this big jazz, but I don't hold people necessarily to that standard, but it is on what I consider, you know, DCPS, whatever that is in each state, to appropriately train their foster parents to give them the appropriate tools to respond to youth in crisis. And I just don't think at that time that that was there. And so both of us had an episode or an issue that was documented. But again, that should have never gone in documentation because that happens maybe not in that exact instance or scenario, but those type of situations happen with quote unquote traditional children. So why is that going in my paperwork, and why is that labeling me and putting me in a bad verbiage when that's just not the case? I literally started college at 17, earned a business degree, did a little bit of what I've already mentioned, and then went on to do a law degree, did 3+ months in DC with a very prominent person. I would say I probably don't have authority issues. But according to my paperwork and the way I'm read out, I do.
Well, it sounds like to me that that pizza box was a symbol of your autonomy, your agency, the possibility of a different future because you could provide for yourself. So I can see the way you describe it, why you wanted to hang on to it. Now, the truth is you could have maybe kept it for a little bit and then got rid of it, right? But you wanted the choice.
Yes, I wanted the choice, and I felt that I was at an age that I deserved that. And so just the fact that I wasn't listened to also was an issue for me. And honestly, that is very reminiscent of how I felt like my time in care was. Some people have great stories and foster care saves their lives. And in some regards, I do think it saved my life, but maybe not in the traditional sense.
So to go back to your application for the bar, you have to be absolutely truthful. There's the issue of integrity, and it's a big role. So you write down that you are, that your parents are the Commonwealth of Kentucky, of the state of Kentucky. How did you feel when you wrote that down? Did it sit with you?
So I would say yes and no. So, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work in spaces to where I get trained. And so I have more of an understanding of what happened in my life. And so I have the advantage and the disadvantage, maybe, because sometimes I'm too therapeutic, right? But I have that understanding to see maybe how my family got to where it got to. So for me, it creates sadness because I really do think that there was a better pathway, and that the weight on my grandmother's shoulder, I feel as though contributed to her early passing. And so if we had proper programming in place, maybe she wouldn't have had to undergo everything she had to undergo. Same thing with me. I grew up very poor. Sometimes, you know, I didn't have food. I didn't have lights. But again, I just leaned back into just sadness because it didn't have to be that way with the proper supports and programming in place. The second part is I really felt scared. A lot of times when you're other, that's held against you. And especially in the legal field, there's a lot of barriers to access, whether intentional or unintentional. And the more other you are, the more likely it is that they may deny you the right to be an attorney if you don't match up to what they think you should. And then, of course, the stereotypes that come with being a foster youth. We have to sit with those realities. And typically the way we're framed is not the type of person that they want to allow into the law field. So I had that fear. But the third part of me, when I got questioned, you have to have an ethical interview in person for them to decide if you're the type of person that they think should be allowed to practice law in your state. Y'all take that for what you will. And so I'm sitting across from this attorney that's 80 plus years old. And he had a lot to say. And one of the things was, and, you know, we ended up on good terms. You know, I don't say this to be malicious, but he was just like, state of Kentucky. Like, you could already see, like, the judgment. And then I became proud. So when he questioned me, I said, yes, I am a product of, you know, foster care. I aged out at 18, and they were considered my parents until 21. Furthermore, I was on their insurance until 26 because they are my legal guardian. I'm proud of the fact that I'm sitting in this chair across from you about ready to become an attorney. Because as you know, with that, just that right there, that it's very unlikely that I would end up here. So I wear that as a badge of honor. I don't deflect from my history because I think it says more about me and what I'm capable of than any of the stereotypes that people want to throw out there, because I don't match a stereotype, which causes people to think and to question their beliefs. And to be like, well, maybe all foster youth are actually capable of more, but X, Y, and Z. And so I do also wear that as a badge of honor. I like to check those status quos for sure.
What a unique confluence of thoughts and ideas and feelings, all while you're just there being interviewed about your ethics and your honesty and your integrity. And you were able to get in touch with that all then or now. And I mean, even if you're just reflecting on it now and you realize it to be true, I'm sure it was really true in the moment. All that stuff coming at you at once, right?
Yes. I feel like my fellow brothers and sisters, as we like to say in foster care, I'm sure they can relate. I feel like just waking up and living our life, everything is complicated just because of our histories. And so I do think that's something that I actually experience on the daily, 100%.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You talked about that there are people not living by their values, some of the organizations you work with. I've been thinking a lot about values, and I want to ask you about your own values. Do you think about what that means, or do you have any? Is it something that comes up? Can you talk to me about that?
Yes. So I don't know where it came from, but I'm pretty sure in my head it was all organic, right? But you know, nothing's really unique anymore is what people like to say. But I was sitting in the car one day and I was undergoing a situation with an organization I used to contract with in my private business. And I just kept going over the situation and going over the situation. And I ultimately landed on the issue I'm having is I live my values. And so that's my tagline. I've been using that since then. And I just say, like, I live my values. So when I say I live my values, I'm challenging myself to stand on the groundwork and the foundation that I claim to be. So various things, you know, for me, I'm Christian. So God, I try to sit on those values. And the positive light, not the negative light, unfortunately, that sometimes gets created with that. Another thing is I stand on justice and injustice. So if I see instances where organizations are put into these situations and they have the chance to live the values that they claim, so foster, youth-centric, and all the good jazz and the holy words that go with this work, and then they underneath the table allow things against what their values are. So for me, I've lost money. I've lost contractors because I choose to live my value. If you're an organization that claims youth voice, but then you're helping youth be homeless or you're creating youth homelessness, okay, you're not living your values. For me, whenever I was put forth with that situation, I didn't put it underneath the table. I stepped up even when I didn't have the time and I did the reach outs. I tried to get the correct verbiage changed so that foster youth homeless could be fixed in that year. And then I felt as though no one else really did that except for like maybe two people. But then we have all these organizations get millions of dollars and their grants are supposed to fix this issue, but they're not doing that work. So that's kind of what I mean when I say I live my values. If I hear of an organization abusing foster youth, like using them as tokens and not in a real ethical way that results in systematic change, I have some questions. Why are you paying them $25 in a gift card to come and speak on one part of their story that you are already screened and that you're asking them to share, not giving them the true, you know, frequency to do what they want to do? Like, that might be problematic to me because are you tokenizing a foster youth or are you actually living your values of working in partnership with youth, right? So that's kind of what I mean when I say I live my values. I truly do challenge myself, even at my own detriment, to not fold on what I claim to be my values.
I have almost nothing to say because I'm just listening to you and just thinking, wow, wow, wow. And so I'm just. All right, I have another question regarding. So you have been adopted through Christ. Is that the correct expression or can you explain that to me and say it better than I'm saying it?
My adoptive family came into my life very, very early, actually before my grandmother passed away. So I'm very fortunate that they were able to meet her and get to know her before that. So through that long history, my now sister, her name's Olivia, we were actually best friends. So been best friends for going on 15, 16 years now, something around there. And so we had already had just one of those relationships where immediately, yep, they were meant to be best friends. And that's something that her mother noticed as well. And so from the very first moment she saw us together. She invited me to her softball game to see her and support her. And this is all in the same week that we had met. And so they had a farm. And so they would invite me out to the farm. And so I would go out, do overnight sleepovers at the farm, go to church with them on Sunday, bright and early, as Catholics do. I was used to lunch after church, but instead I got breakfast after church whenever I was over there. And so that continued on, even through foster care. So we lost contact a little bit during my first initial placements in foster care. She did not know what happened to me. I just disappeared. We weren't allowed cell phones, online communication. So literally I was almost trapped. And so it took my, I think it was one of my last foster homes, I was allowed to make a Facebook. And so I found her on Facebook again. I let her know what happened. And that weekend, her mom's picking me up and getting me from my foster parents' house, and we're staying the night. And so that relationship continued to be a thing. I would go there for holidays and all that jazz. So then fast forward to 2017, I believe, or 16, I was about ready to graduate from undergrad with my business degree. And I remember all the women kind of met me at my favorite restaurant, and I thought something was up, but I didn't know what was up. And they presented me with an official, official adoption certificate that just announces to the world and to Christ and everyone else that through Christ's eyes, and when we eventually pass away, that will be my heavenly family. So they had made a pledge to God, the church, and their others that they were going to treat me as a daughter now, which in the Catholic faith, especially I believe they're Orthodox Catholics. So definitely in the Orthodox Catholic faith, they live their values in a sense. So they take familyhood and Christ and all that to be more sacred than just the law. And so from that day forward, I agreed to, you know, be in their heavenly family and all that jazz. And so I like to say, and I classify it as an adoption through Christ. I was just at my dad's. I was just at my mom's house on Sunday, and we did family Thanksgiving. My sister, who kind of brought me into the family, she wasn't even there, but it's not a thought. I show up no matter what, just like any other family member. Christmas, mom's helping me plan my upcoming wedding, all that jazz. So they treat me like family, and they take that pledge of familyhood seriously. And so that's just been great for me. I already felt like family. I treated them like family. But to have someone actually say, this is official, like this is serious for us. We want you. This is home. You're welcome no matter what and no matter when.
I think that's what everybody wants to hear. Even if you haven't lost your bio family, you want to feel like it's unconditional. You're here with us forever. You are ours. We are yours. And that must have been a really nice feeling, you know, finally. Did it take away a little bit of the sting of your lack of security as a child? Or did it just, I'm not sure what I'm asking, but I think you understand, right? Like, did it?
Yeah.
Did it take away a little bit of the sting?
So this is probably an un-PC answer. And, you know, I love my family, and they're going to probably likely hear this. So I say this next part with love. I think it's supplemented. And, you know, it's one of those things that we talked about where it's just so complex. I literally had that situation happen on Sunday. And I was just like, Glenda, walk it back a little bit. Because at the end of the day, like, you do have your family, my bio family. I rarely speak with my biological mother. And I normally never speak with my biological father. So that's the case, but I'm very close with other people in my bio family, like my siblings, my uncle, my cousins, all that jazz. So I have a very strong bio family unit, and actually that relationship is what made me express not wanting to be adopted, even in foster care. So, you know, you always are required by law to put them on that one website, and it's an adoption site because I was TPR. And I remember having a very frank conversation at that time, at pretty young, 16 or so, 15. And I told my social worker, I said, I don't want to be adopted, because to me, adoption equated me not having my bio family anymore. And I was old enough to have a very solid foundation there. And so I wasn't willing in my head to give up that connection. And so I was never adopted in foster care. Now, when it came to them wanting to adopt me, I actually don't want to be adult adopted. And even with all the people that love me, I've chosen, I don't really need that, because actions and words and values speak louder than like paper. So they supplemented that hurt. You know, I think I'm always going to struggle with really conceptualizing my parents as my parents, if that makes sense. I still struggle with, well, if I was homeless, you know, would they offer me a place to live? Which the answer is yes. But through the trauma, it makes me feel like, I don't know if I'll ever 100% feel secure, safe, even if logically I am in so many facets. I will always struggle with like, or I'll question it, like, am I truly X, Y, and Z? Or do I belong? Do people think of me as X, Y, and Z? And so just almost like, you know, battered syndrome or something. That's just always going to be something that I'm going to have to check in my head. So I wasn't looking for a family replacement. You know, I'm pretty secure in my feelings and my thoughts when it comes to like my childhood and my bio family, which is like my family, obviously. So it supplemented, it added an extra layer of comfort and assurance and love and all that jazz that couldn't be there without like that official thing. So I think that's what I kind of feel like. It supplemented my stuff.
And you're in love now. You're the fiancé. You're about to be married. You're planning your wedding. What's that like? What's going on? What's he like?
Oh man. Listen, I was not the long-term commitment type, and not in the sense that I didn't want to be committed, but obviously I had a lot of stuff I had to work through before I could have what I like to say an adult relationship. But I'm very Christian, and so I believed in dating for marriage and not just dating to date personally. Now, I dated, but I did not get in relationships unless I saw a true future. So I had two prior boyfriends, both that ended up fizzling out within a year. And so here comes Mr. Weston, my fiance. I had just turned 22. I had just gotten my big, you know, I'm coming off of 21 where I'm doing big girl stuff and I was so proud and I'm like, you know, confident. And then 22, I'm working in the commissioner's office at that time. I'm working with the governor at that time. And so, you know, I didn't know if I wanted a man, okay? Because Glenda was going to be a powerhouse. Now, a partner, right? A partner is great, but I had never seen a lot of true partnerships up until that point. And so I thought certain things had to happen in a relationship for it, you know, and I wasn't ready for those aspects of relationship. And, you know, I don't think I'm, you know, Miss Beauty Queen, but I think I'm relatively pretty. And so I never really struggled much with finding people to date. And so it wasn't really a concern of mine. Well, we meet happenstance, as most things like this do. And so we met in like September, but not officially. It was a dating app. This is 20 whatever year. So dating apps are in. And again, I don't like to rush things. So it took, I think, a month and a half of us just conversating, right? Before we ever physically met. I got violently sick on October 31st. Is that Halloween? Halloween. Yes. I got violently sick on Halloween of 2017. I had all these plans. He was like, well, let me drive 3+ hours away and we could meet for the first time and we, you know, we could just hang out for Halloween, you know, whatever. And I was thinking, great, I'm not getting makeup on, obviously. Like I had been really violently ill, so there's no way I could pull myself together. But you know what? I said, forget it. You know, normally I was really stressed about those kind of first meetings. And for whatever reason, I had peace. This was planned right on Halloween. So no prep. And I was like, sure, see you soon. And then after that, 9 months of dating and getting to know each other. And then we officially started dating July 15th of 2018. So we have actually been
take
together.
Your time. Women.
Whoa. Okay. Well, you got to remember, three of those years was law school. I mean, I'm not getting married.
Okay. Yep. I got you. Right.
So, and you know, I had never dated someone long term. So, you know, I didn't know what issues I actually had because, right, other issues seem to pop up in different scenarios. So, I had never had a long term partner that I actually needed or wanted to make it work with. And so, you know, through that initial part of the relationship, I was like, okay, I'm going to do some therapeutic practices to get my mind, body, soul right. And so I did. And that foundation has gotten us to 6 years. And then he proposed on our 5-year dating anniversary. But again, we talked for 9 months. That counts. And so on our 5-year dating anniversary of this year, he proposed. I was actually in Washington, D.C., flew in for the weekend to visit, and he did it. And it just was amazing. So yeah, I'm planning my wedding. We've been together for a lot of years. So more than 6 years, some marriages don't last that long. So I really do like to take my time. And when I make a commitment, maybe obvious, but I take my commitments very, very seriously. And I really believe in the sacrament of marriage and what all that means. And so, yeah, I feel good, but it was hard. It was hard getting here, especially with my history. It really has been. And then adapting to family styles, because, you know, I had a very untraditional upbringing. That has also been very interesting to see.
Right. How you work with somebody else's family that is not like yours, and figuring out the dynamics and all that stuff, right?
Exactly. It can be challenging, especially if, so obviously, right, I've seen other people have parents and behave with their parents. But when you're dating someone, you have more of an intimate view into what those relationships can look like day to day. And so I remember not too long ago, maybe a year ago, maybe a little less than that, Weston pretty much never goes to the hospital, never gets sick. And he got very, very sick out of nowhere. And he did not look good. He was not doing good. And so it was like 2 a.m., midnight or something along those lines. And I got him ready and we went to the ER. And I had a really big work event the next day. Like, I'm talking, you know, money was spent into it. I was one of the, you know, one of the pieces that was needed for it to go forth. A lot of time and preparation. And I was thinking, what am I going to do? You know, because I got to, you know, stand by my partner and help him get better, nurse him back to health. I don't want to leave him. And without me even asking, his mom was like, okay, you got that work thing. I'll come stay with him that evening. I'll stay the night. Something along those lines. She came up with homemade chicken noodle soup in a multi-gallon bucket. She had some like cookies or cinnamon roll, something for them to make as well. Weirdly enough, I was like, so this kind of is like what it means to have a mom. And not in like a downplaying way, but like, I would honestly, I never feel comfortable enough to ever ask for things, which again is another resolve very common among people that go through what I go through. So like, even if I wanted that from one of my moms, I honestly would absolutely never ask, because I don't want to be an inconvenience. Literally, that's how it works in my head. I don't want to be an inconvenience and be so much of an inconvenience that in my head, they regret like wanting me to be theirs. And that's very irrational. And I can claim it's irrational. And I know it's irrational. But you know, we feel what we feel. And so I was just like, what a thing for his mom to not need to be asked, but comes as a mother, right? Shows up, drives over an hour away one way, comes with the chicken noodle soup, nurses this man back to health, you know, puts the cloth, like comfort, just, and you know, he's turning 29 in April. So he's not some baby, but like when you have a mother, they show up for life. And so seeing how she shows up in her boy's life has been beautiful, but also sometimes hard. Because I do wish I had a little bit more of that intimacy, and just like, just not having to ask, but sometimes people don't know if you don't ask. So one of those things where I wouldn't have to ask. Right. And that's just something I don't know if I'll ever have, just because, you know, it's not my biological mother and that's not my biological comfort. I don't take parenthood for granted. Right. Some people are just like I asked Weston, he's like, well, that's just my mom. And I'm like, woof. I said, it is your mom, but like, she made a choice to be a mother to you. She made a choice. She makes a daily choice on how she wants to show up as a mother. So like, no, it's not just she's my mom. You appreciate her for those things and you give her grace and value because she is giving you value, just like his father, you know, in that, you know, in the reverse, you honor your parents, especially parents who are doing what they can, and they gave you the best of what they could, and they try to show up in whatever way they could. And that's definitely his parents. Obviously, I don't have a relationship with my two bio parents, and that's a choice. But sometimes that does have to happen. I'm not an advocate for nourishing toxic relationships. If it's not added value in your life and it's actually taking away from your peace and happiness, I'm a cutoff queen. I'm a cutoff queen if that's the instance. So I will do what I need to do to protect myself and others. But when it is a parent that's deserving, I'm going above and beyond. Even as myself, I really try to tell her I love her. I tell his dad I appreciate him and the way he shows up for me. I texted his brother maybe a month back, and I said, you know, we recently moved. And I was just like, thank you. And I appreciate the way you show up, not only for Weston, but the way you show up for me, because he doesn't have to. No one has to. And so I just really value those relationships.
Have you thought about motherhood for yourself? What kind of mother you might be and what that means?
Oh, man.
You look all excited.
Well, it's so funny, right? Because I'm at that age, good or bad. I'm currently 28. I'll be turning 29 next year. And as you know, the 30, the big 3-0, your body, and as a woman, you have a window. And so, you know, I was texting my sister, actually my best friend, one of my best friends, Mary, the other day, who is she's older than me. So she has some more life experience on her. She's a mother of one. She's a career woman, you know, which right now is what I am. And so I asked her very candid questions, and I said, unfortunately, I feel like the world and my body is going to force me to make a decision before maybe I'm ready to make a decision. But of course, I'm saying that at my current age. So I think, honestly, I used to 100% 100%. And then as you get older and the more you gain knowledge, the more you understand what that actually means. And so now I'm more of a 50-50. I do think ultimately I will choose to have kids. I think I'm leaning more towards adoption and foster care versus biologically having a child. Now that may change, but I've also never been a woman that is excited or can't wait to physically be pregnant. I am excited for what I know motherhood could do, parenthood. I'm excited for those aspects of it. I really do believe that children are double-sword, right? You get so much value out of the relationship and the love, and they enrich your life. But also, in some regards, sometimes it can take away, and you have to sit with yourself and say, you know, well, what kind of mother would I want to be? And what kind of life do I want? And can those two go together? And so that's an ongoing conversation that I have with myself. But ultimately, I think I'll end up with two kids, right? How we all plan our lives. I think I'll end up with two kids, likely one adopted or adopted into foster care, what have you, and then one maybe biological. I'm not opposed. Yeah, one biological, but I think I'll be a mother at some point, but I'm definitely not going to be a young mother. That's for sure. I'm thinking 33s, baby, 33s.
Well, it's really good that you're thinking about it and making a very conscious choice. You know, that's a guarantee for success if you put your heart and mind behind a very important phase of life. Let me ask you another question, what I ask all my guests. What is the one thing that no one would ever know about you unless you told them?
So this is going to be an interesting one. Maybe. I don't know. I should have maybe went back and listened to all the podcasts before, but I didn't, because I wanted this to be very organic and just authentic. So I held myself off from being type A. So one thing that I would say that people may start to see in me, but may not be apparent, especially if they knew me when I was younger. I went through, I would say the last 3 to 4 years, rigorously unlearning bad habits and also learning myself. I used to just think I knew myself just organically. I know Glenda. I live in this body every single day of my life, and I know who she is. And in some regards, that was true. But also, I hadn't done the hard work of really getting to understand Glenda with a trauma lens, Glenda with a hurt lens, Glenda with a partner lens. And so I took it upon myself to really do that hard work. I learned about ACEs, and I learned about trauma responses and triggers. And I learned about asking yourself why you did a certain action and drilling down to understand even deeper than why you did the action and how to prevent it further. And so that's something that I just did in the last 3 to 4 years. And that has really changed the way that I show up, not only for myself, but for others. And I show up in a very different way, still authentic to who I was before, but I really show up in a pure, peaceful way. And not just I show up. And so I lower, like when I want to get angry or frustrated, back in the day, I would just quote unquote pop off. But now I don't do that. I don't like to get there. Back in the past, I may have liked to get there because I was so used to toxic situations. But then when I unlearned that behavior and I learned what it meant to sit in peace and to sit in your knowledge of who you are, it really opened up the world for me. And that's something that I'm so proud of. I'm more proud of that than my law degree. In DC, they said, what's your one accomplishment that you're the most proud of? And I wrote up there my emotional intelligence and my self-intelligence, because that's what I'm most proud of. Because if you've done that work, you know how hard it is. It's raw. You got to look at your parts, both good and ugly. And for someone that likes to be a good person, sometimes it can be very hard to look at the ugly and admit to yourself that there are some uglies, but then doing the hard work to undo those uglies. So yeah, that's it for me. That's what I love. And that's what I'm proud of.
You should be proud. Bravo. Bravo to you. And anything else you'd like to say, Glenda?
You know, I do want to just take a moment. I said, I love to honor people who live their values. And so I used to do a lot of media. Some media, was not happy media. Some regards, I was really taken advantage of from being really young initially in this foster work and doing media and maybe not the most healthiest ways. And so I've never had someone come to me from media and say, you know, first off, if you don't like something, we can work through that. Never had that offered out to me before. I never had someone say, actually, I don't believe in scripted. I want your most authentic and organic self. Normally, people come with an agenda, good or bad. They have certain questions. They want certain parts of your story. It's a semi-rehearsed. And so I just want to say, I knew that you were someone I wanted to be in partnership with, as my pastor likes to say, because those were your responses. So I actually kind of stopped doing media because of the harm that it was causing. But this has really been great. And it really encourages me and reassures me that there are people out there that are doing the good work. They are living their values. And the more I see that, the more it encourages me to work against the grain and to show up in an authentic way and in a truthful way. So just thank you for doing your work the way that you do it. It matters.
Thank you. That's the nicest thing I've heard in a long time. Okay, dearie, you have a wonderful holiday.
Okay, thank you.
After we were done with the interview, Glenda had a few other things to say. So here they are.
Earlier, I mentioned that I really love and try to prioritize working with companies and organizations that live their values. And one of those organizations that I have the absolute pleasure of both working with and for is iFoster. iFoster is just one of those champion organizations that are so rare in this type of work. iFoster is really unique because the founder and the CEO is actually someone with lived experience. And I think having an organization head that has a lived experience, knows what that population is and is coming from, really makes them rooted in their values and causes, where sometimes I don't see that in other organizations. And so I really like to give kudos and shout outs when I see people doing the real work. And so to Sarita and iFoster, thank you for being who you all are. Thank you for all the help and the services and the resources and the uplifting that you all do as an organization and as human beings. I'm just so proud to be a person involved in working for iFoster, and that's something that I haven't always been able to say. So just really big kudos to them and their organization. Earlier, you asked me, what about Glenda? What is Glenda doing now? What does Glenda hope to do in the future? And I really had to sit with that. I feel like that is such a big question, and maybe it's a question that we don't give enough weight to. So I'll attempt to answer it, but as I indicated earlier, I really try to go where I feel called. So I guess a little over 3 years ago, I was in the middle of law school, and funny enough, I felt called to get back into youth work. So foster care and all that good stuff that I had been doing previously, prior to law school. So I felt so called that I reached out to one of my really good friends who is now my co-CEO, business partner. And I said, let's do this. And so we opened up Wright & Hunter Consulting. And so that's something that we've put a lot of time and energy into. That is a child welfare consulting firm. We've had the pleasure of working in several states, doing several different projects, all the way from youth building, capacity building, to project management, to keynoting, to workshops. And so that's something that I'm still very passionate about and something that I'd like to see grow and grow and grow. Maybe similar to iFoster, obviously not the same exact thing, but I'd love to see my impact and our impact as individuals and as a company really grow and foster. And so that's something that I'm really hoping to see in the future. Maybe a couple more degrees, maybe in my future, we'll see. Law school really took it out of me. I would love to potentially run for office one day if I feel called to do that, probably several years from now, but that is something that I do keep coming back to. I love advocating. I love working for others. I love bettering my state. I love bettering my country, whatever that looks like. And I love supporting and giving people inroads and roads to success where maybe they have not always been. So that's something I'm really hoping to see more of in my future. I guess time will tell, right? For all things, you know, we have to see where we end up. And so that's what I'm hopeful for. I want to spend more time with loved ones, my family. That's something that always centers me and always helps me keep going. I want to be more centered in my faith, of course, because, you know, without him, what do we have?
Thank you, Glenda, for sharing your story with us. I'm really struck by that metaphor of the pizza box. And yeah, it's just a pizza box, but it really did represent your independence. I mean, people do keep the first dollar they earned and pin it on a wall. Why not a pizza box? Thanks again for taking the time to come here and share your story. So we're taking a little break until our season 4 starts, but we may have some bonus episodes coming along the way. And in 2024, we'll be exploring some very big themes, including foster care history from the Bible to America today, how the lived foster care experience exists in world literature and popular culture, generational foster care, race and poverty bias in foster care, and many others. So check back in mid-January and join us as we speak to others about the foster care system and our goals to improve it for those who are supported by it. Thank you for listening and be well. If you or someone you know is harming themselves or thinking about harming themselves, go to crisistextline.org. If you see something, say something. If you suspect a child's health or safety is jeopardized in any way by parents or anyone else, contact the Child Protective Services Agency in your county. 24-hour hotlines are staffed by trained social workers who will help you through the process, and you can do so anonymously. In California, you can call the Child Protection Hotline at 800-540-4000. So if you see something, say something. You might be saving a child's life. If you want to know more about becoming a CASA anywhere in the country, go to nationalcasagal.org. And in LA, casala.org. And if you want to know more about becoming a foster parent, check out the National Foster Parent Association at nfponline.org. There's also faithfosterfamilies.org and adoptuskids.org. There's tons of other information online as well, so you can just hunt around. We also want to thank the supremely talented Christina Apostolopoulos for her beautiful original music. You can find her music on Spotify or Instagram at Christina Aposta. And also thank you to Yukon Har for his engineering. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you hear and you find it as valuable as we do, please rate us and hit subscribe. You can also make a donation at bonusbabies.org. See you next time.